Okay, so I have Helen and Barry Gorthwist sitting with me. They live on Howland, but both of them have interesting histories from Harbord Village. So I would like to thank you both for coming to speak to us, to our history committee. And I'm going to ask each of you to just tell me on the tape when you lived here, the ages that you were, or with you, your family history of your father's business. Okay, so Barry, you want to start?
Okay, so my parents came here from a displaced persons camp in Germany in 1948, and they arrived in May. And at first lived in Kensington Market, one-bedroom walk-up apartment with another couple and their child. So there were four adults and two children in a one-bedroom apartment. And then when their second child and I were born, it got a little crowded, having eight people in a one-bedroom apartment. So my parents bought a house on Borden Street, 40 Borden. It was an infill house, so it wasn't one of the three stories. It had been built in 1925, presumably because the original house had deteriorated. And so I was a week old when we moved into it. So I don't remember the apartment on Denison Avenue too well. So that was my... So I was brought up, and we lived there until I was 8 years old, eight and a half. So I spent my first 8.5 years in Harbord Village area.
Do you have any idea why they chose to live in this part of the city? After they left Denison, why they chose to live here?
This was the Jewish area of the city. So the few blocks east of Bathurst and west of Bathurst, north of College to Harbord, were where the Jewish immigrant population lived. So my father's partner and cousin lived on Beatrice Street, so just a few blocks further west, but just between Harbord and College. And the area was mostly Jewish at that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that was the major drawing card for that.
College Street had tons of Jewish stores on it and delicatessen and stuff. And obviously, if we went down south on Spadina, also, and into Kensington Market, there was a lot of Jewish businesses and restaurants.
Well, and it's so understandable that people will want to be, especially when they come as immigrants that they've been through, if they were through, want to be where they're with others of their kind.
Yeah, and that tradition still is in Toronto. Yeah. So you get Italian areas, you've got Portuguese areas, you've got Little India, so it's not a bad thing.
It isn't, and it's normal. What language did your parents speak?
In the home, until the kids went to school, they spoke Yiddish, so that was our first language. My mother took English classes. My father picked up some English because he opened a store in Kensington Market, But once we started going to school, we spoke mostly English in the house. And my parents, if they didn't want the kids to hear something, spoke Polish. So that way we couldn't understand.
So Yiddish was your first language?
Yeah.
And you learned English by going out on the street and playing with the kids?
And going to school.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of the kids on the street also, their parents spoke Yiddish as well. So
of course.
It wasn't unusual.
And what did your father open in Kensington Market?
So when his parents had a goose farm and sold geese in the old country, so he knew poultry very well. So his first job, he worked for Irving Ungerman, who still owns Royce DuPont Poultry. So he worked for him for a while to save up enough money to put a down payment, he and his cousin, on the store that they bought at 188 Baldwin Street. So then it was a poultry store. Mostly chickens, so he moved a little bit away from geese, but it was still in the same family, and he had that store for 20 years.
Did you work there at all, or spend time there?
My father and his cousin could run it very well, but there were some times when one of them was on vacation or something, so like Christmas time or something, I would work and help my dad. The fascinating thing is that he had some rooms above it, which he rented out. And one of the people he rented it to were another Polish family who had escaped through the war and gone to Russia, and eventually were sort of transported by the Soviets to Uzbekistan. So they were briefly in Israel and then came to Toronto. And the little boy who also helped my father, who's a few years older than me, is now my son's father-in-law.
So it's
a small world out there.
When did you make that connection? When did you figure that out?
Before they were married.
Yeah.
When they were dating, when we were doing Jewish geography.
Geography, we figured it out, yeah. So it,
The link actually came when we had transferred various bar mitzvah movies onto a DVD and we were watching, and Daniel's fiance came in the middle of it, and she looked at the screen and she says, "That's my booby." And we said, "Oh, no, don't be silly, thing," you know.
Everybody had that kind of hairdo in the 60s and stuff.
But it was her booby.
And not only did they were at my bar mitzvah, they were at our wedding as well.
And I have the list that gave us that check. And they sat at table 20.
Oh, marvelous.
So when, it was a connection.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
When she died, so when our daughter-in-law's grandmother died, she was in her 90s. She's still living in her own apartment. And when they cleaned it out, they found the thank you card for my bar mitzvah, which was a picture of the table that she sat at. So it was all her friends. She was sitting with her friends. So she didn't keep it because of the thank you card. It was a picture of all her closest friends sitting at the same table.
Oh, my God. Saw it all those decades later.
Yeah.
It's a marvelous story. Oh, fantastic. Okay. So, and when you did work there, what were some of the jobs that you did?
You helped the customers pick out a chicken. So they were most of the chickens were cleaned and, butchered, all ready to be prepared to be sold. But there were two groups of people who had to buy live chickens. And one were the Chinese, probably because they wanted to make sure it was freshly killed. Uh-huh. And so in those cases, you run out and grab a fresh chicken, and a live chicken, and bring it in.
Who's you? Who would do it?
Anybody was there. Chickens are easy. Turkeys are easy, too. The ones that are a problem are ducks, because normally poultry you hold by the legs and just sort of hang there and don't cause any trouble, but ducks will bite you. So ducks you have to hold by the neck. So they were the problem poultry.
Did you ever do that?
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean? Oh, yeah.
Of course. When I helped my dad. Remember, we lived down here. So I was,
Anyway, God.
So the other group that you had to sell live. So those chickens, my father would, after they picked out the right live chicken that they were sure was fresh, my father would butcher for them, and he had a machine that took off the feathers and stuff, and he would sell it to them. But
you said it was the Chinese,
and the other group was Orthodox Jews. Anybody who had to, so that they had to be sure that it was a kosher chicken that was killed properly. So they would pick out one, and then I would run it over to Zalman de Shoichet, who worked in a laneway just behind. Baldwin Street, so he was just 100 meters away, and I would take the chickens to him, and he would make sure they were richly slaughtered in the proper way and that they met all the criteria to be kosher, and then I'd bring it back. And Zalma was a wonderful, wonderful man, but his work clothes were obviously a white lab coat always spattered with blood,
His
yarmulke on. But then when he cleaned up and went home, he always wore the nattiest sports jackets and hats. He was adorable. Aww. The nicest, nicest man.
Wonderful memories. How old were you when you started working there?
It was after we moved away from Kensington. Uh-huh. I really made a significant, really helped because I was too young at 8. But probably around 10, 12, 14. So my father sold the store when I was 18. Mm-hmm. So that was somewhat before then.
Well, I've just been educated. Yeah. What's easier to kill, what's harder to kill, and why?
That store is now part of Tom's Place on Baldwin Street.
God, I know exactly where that is.
Yeah.
So you have some fascinating memories of that.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any pictures of it?
We have some pictures of Kensington Market that there's a famous photographer. So in the 60s, he was an amateur then. Now he's selling them. Harry Joy, and he took tons and tons of pictures of Kensington Market. And very few of my father's store, but a lot of my uncle's store, which was Kitty Cat across the street.
Uh-huh.
And my father's good friends had another poultry store, the two Shires, Shire Passion, Shire Kutnovsky. So they have a beautiful picture of him that Harry Joy took.
Is Kensington and Baldwin part of Harvard Village?
No, but it's one of the questions I ask because of Harvard Village ends at college, Bloor to College, Spadina to Bathurst. but people love the Kensington Market. There is a lot of ambivalence about the University of Toronto. It's been called the bully. It's been called all kinds of things. Kensington Market is universally loved. Yeah. And significant, and people come here for a variety of reasons, but one reason in the past, and even now, people really do love the market.
I remember once years ago walking with a visiting professor who's giving lectures here in Toronto, who was at Duke University, and we walked through Kensington Market. He was originally from Brooklyn. He said, oh, it's just like when I was a little boy.
And he
really liked it.
It's changing, but not as quickly as what's it called? Avenue Road north of Bloor, Yorkville. I came to Toronto in 1968, and Yorkville was just, I had just come from California. It was an extension of what I had had. It seemed to me I blinked, and all of a sudden it's this new Yorkville. And so Kensington is changing, but much more slowly.
The big cut point for me, which changed it dramatically, was I think in about 88 when live animals were no longer allowed to be sold. So that changed the whole nature of the market from when you walked through and there was all these live animals making noises and stuff and the smells of animals and stuff, and that ended abruptly.
Well,
the city
you just
passed
taught me something else, because when I came, there were live animals and I didn't know that a law had been passed.
Yeah, the city made it illegal because they were kept in crates. There's no space.
Right.
And so it was felt to be cruel.
Very informative.
The interesting thing is most of the chickens my father in most of his career would have been now called free-range chickens because nobody had these big poultry farms. The work week was a little bit different for him. So like Tuesday to Saturday, he would start work around 6 a.m. Monday to Thursday, work till about 9. And Friday and Saturday till about 6. And then he'd start Monday morning at 2 a.m. To go out to the country to get produce. The store wasn't open on Mondays, closed Saturday around 6. And so he had the briefest of weekends off. Like, he didn't even have a full 24 hours, it seemed. And,
so you grew up with a role model of working hard is not...
Yeah, my father loved to work.
Uh-huh. So, well, he sure did what he loved.
He worked an awful lot in those days. Yeah.
So Helen, let me come to you. We'll gather together. And I'd like you, because your story is a bit different, but I'd love you to tell us why you're included in being interviewed for Harvard Village, please.
My dad owned a dental lab, AAA Dental Lab, at 124 Harvard, which is directly across from the Harvard Bakery, is now Tati Restaurant. And he would have started his business. He came to Toronto from Montreal around 1936, I think. So he opened the lab then, and he ran it straight through until he died in 1956. And then my brother Bernie took it over, and it was located there, I think, until the late 80s. I'm not 100% sure when it moved. It eventually moved to Clinton
and
Bloor.
Oh, so it didn't go very far.
No,
it went around the corner. But so it was a dental lab, and when it moved out, it was empty for a while, and then it became Kensington Kitchen Restaurant. So I remember when I was a little girl going down to the lab, they called it, and helping my father. Not really helping, because I was too little. So I remember sitting on a stool in the lab and him making me... little animals out of the hot wax that they use to make dental molds, and to keep me quiet and happy. And if I was a very good girl, we could go to the Harvard Bakery and get a cookie.
What kind of cookie?
And I would always get the honey cookies because they were the biggest cookies. They used to be very big discs with jam in the middle. And, you know, if the option is the same, why get a little cookie? Go for the bigger one. And they are my favorite cookies in the whole world. And so I remember Harvard Fish was right next door to Harvard Bakery, where there's a restaurant now. I believe it's called Loire.
Yeah.
Loire.
Yeah.
That was Harvard Fish Company. And then there was the Harvard Bakery. I don't remember all the other stores because I was too little. But then I also worked with my brothers. They would always give me weekend jobs or afternoon jobs when I was, like, you know, from 12 to... 16, 17 years old, so I used to go down on Saturdays and help in the lab and be receptionist or do odd jobs or whatever. There was a dentist who worked for them. His name was Dr. Stewart.
And where was that? Well, when they were still on Harvard?
Still on Harvard. So his office was there through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, I think. So there was an in-house dentist, and I don't remember his first name. Lovely man. And they also had a slew of odd people who did odd jobs, who sort of, they always looked to me like they were sort of previously homeless, but somehow they would always come in and they were the errand boys or running, you were always running between various dentist offices and the lab where the false teeth were made, or over to different labs that did other procedures and picking stuff up. So there's all this courier work.
And how did they get
done by
these
odd people?
What was their transportation?
I think streetcar.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Or bike. Or
yeah.
It was not a formal thing.
Yeah.
What else? And my parents lived on Palmerston, south of Bloor, between Bloor and Harvard. So it wasn't far for my dad to go to work.
And then moved to Walmer Road.
Between what and what on Walmer? North of Bloor or north of...
Yeah, between Bloor and DuPont.
So your family was very much in this neighborhood.
Yes.
And you just kind of skirted Harvard Village.
But by the time she was born, they weren't living down there anymore.
Yeah, they had smaller and smaller homes. So they went from Palmerston to Walmer to Elmridge to Glen Grove, and I was born in Glen Grove.
But everybody came down here because of the business, your
right.
father's business and then your brother's business, and that kept you... So both of you were working at young ages. At 12 and 14 and 16, you were working in
family
businesses.
The world was different then. You know, when I was 6 years old, your parents were thinking of me, sending you out to buy milk or bread or something. So you wouldn't do that to a 6 or 7 year old
nowadays. What store did you go to when you were 6 on board, and where would you buy bread?
Oh, go on to college. So Harvard was far north, right? So we gravitated towards College Street. So all the stores and stuff that we used to go to were there. So on Sundays sometimes we'd go to Becker's, which was a famous delicatessen at the corner of Spadina and College. And I remember my sister being indignant when they raised the price of a corned beef sandwich to 45 cents, and she said, nobody will ever buy this. And there was a candy store, you know, a variety store at the corner of College and Borden that I always used to go to. And I went to King Edward Public School, and Helen's mother actually was there in
My mother was born on Ulster Street.
Yeah, she was born in New York City.
My mother was born in New York City, moved to Toronto in 1912 when she was 2, and lived on Ulster and went to
King Edward
Public School.
So you and your mother-in-law went to the same elementary school.
I think the most exciting part of going to that school was when I was in grade 1 when construction was a little bit faster in those days. So they started when I was in kindergarten building the new school on the same lot. And when we came in September, the new school was ready. We go into the new school, and we could, from our classroom in grade 1, we could see where the wrecking ball was smashing down the old school. We were all cheering as the wrecking ball hit the old school. It was a lot of fun.
Until what grade did you live here? Until grade 3?
Grade 4.
Grade 4, okay.
So I did 2 and 3 in 1 year. Because they were running out of space in the school.
How did you get to school?
I walked. It was very close. They were just around the corner. So it took a while because you had to pick up all your friends on the way. And then after school, we went to the Brunswick Street Tomatora, where Doctors' Hospital, now Kensington Gardens Nursing Home, is. And it couldn't be more than 150 meters away because there was a lane way that went through. So you didn't have to go down to college and walk around. You could go through the street. But we had about half hour, 40 minutes in between the end of public school and starting. We could almost always, just barely made it. It was very difficult to get there in that short period of time.
But what you're saying is there were no parents taking you back and forth. And the kids were playing with each other.
Oh, yeah.
And the parents weren't worrying, oh, my God, my 7-year-old is walking on the street. Yeah.
It's a different world.
Yeah.
And you used the lane, you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Laneways, whatever, any way that was fastest. And we there was, most of us got money to buy something in between public school and going to Tomator. So we go and figure out what to buy, some candy or this. And, you know, but there are some very good bakeries, so you can also buy baked goods and stuff. So sometimes we would
So talk
that.
To me about, see, that's something that I've noticed, that if you live close to Bloor or Harvard or college, you being closest to college,
yeah.
You knew those were the stores that you knew.
Yeah, we knew the owners. You know, they knew, when you came in, they knew that you wanted to get a rye bread because that's what your mother always sent you for, right? So you barely had to even ask. I used to go, like, from when I was 5 years old, I'd go for my own haircuts. So I'd go, they knew what my mother must have taken. I don't remember. My mother must have taken me once and said, this is how you're supposed to cut it. And from then on, I went by myself.
But the children were so much more independent. The parents were less anxious at that time, obviously.
Yeah. I don't think it's any more dangerous now. I think it's just everybody knows about all the dangers because communication is so effective and the media is so ever present.
I agree with you completely. Yeah.
But, you know, in our house, we had 40 Borden, is a small house. You know, it's not particularly large, but there were the four of us. And then the last couple of years, five of us in our family. And that's when we moved from having two boarders to one boarder. So you could make the mortgage payments and pay off the house faster.
And these boarders were strangers. I mean,
yeah.
They weren't
well, they
family.
They were long-term boarders after a while. So we had one who was there, Mr. Farkas, who was basically there from the time they bought the house. And he was just the most wonderful guy. So they started off as strangers. You know, you rent it out. But they would eat dinner with us. So it wasn't like they were... strange, that was part of the deal.
Yeah.
And I still remember we had this huge pear tree in our backyard, and he made this long pole, and he soldered a tin can onto it so I could go and pull a pear down and eat a fresh pear. I still don't like pears that much, but it was a lot of fun to pull them down.
And your mother said when your brother was born and he never slept, Mr. Farkas would walk with him for
him.
Hours.
Oh.
So he was really like a family member.
Yeah.
But what's interesting...
We wanted him, when we moved up to the suburbs, yeah. My mother desperately wanted him to come with us, but he said, no, all my friends are down here. I'm going to stay downtown.
But see how you called him Mr. Farkas. Our generation did that. Now they would call him by his first name.
I don't know if he had a first name. I never knew about it if he did.
He was too poor.
Yeah, he couldn't afford it. A nice man.
Yeah, and creative. I mean, what a clever idea.
It was so much fun getting the pears. He's such a nice guy. And I remember the year before we moved away, my father bought his first car because he knew he was going to be driving down. And so he probably got a good deal or whatever. It was an Oldsmobile. Of course, it meant he could never buy anything else but an Oldsmobile for the rest of his life because his first car was an Oldsmobile. But we had there was a laneway in back and you could park there, but never had to because his was the only car on the street. There were no permits, no fighting for spots. Yeah, I always parked it right in front of our house. Now,
so
he didn't.
Your neighbors did not, nobody could afford a car, you're saying?
Yeah. The only people who had cars were people who lived in the suburbs. He didn't really need a car.
Yeah.
Like when we lived there, my father walked to work. So he bought it, it was a 57 Olds. So he bought it the year before we moved.
Where did he keep his truck? He had a truck for the
He had a place to park it in Kensington. Mm. But sometimes, you know, if he was tired, and then coming back, he would leave it there. He'd park it in front. There was two cars parked in, you know, from Harvard to college. There might be two cars ever parked there. And so there was no need to get permits and stuff because nobody had cars downtown in those days.
Well, I use my car, but I use TTC and my bike and my legs much more than I use my car. Now, of course, you, after all these years, you live on Howland, which is...
the continuation of Borden. So. This yeah. When I was a baby and my mother had one of the prams, her favorite walk was to go up to St. Albans Park and see the beautiful homes up there.
And that's where we live.
That's where we live now,
right across from St. Albans Park.
Yeah.
And when we told her that we were buying this house when we decided to move down about 11, 12 years ago, we told my mother-in-law that we were moving down. She said, I worked so hard to get out of that neighborhood. Because to her, moving up north was prosperity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And us moving back downtown was not a good thing, but we assured her that it was a good move.
Yeah.
I think that as people had enough money, they moved, and that they all felt the same way that you just described your mother-in-law felt. Yeah, yeah.
Well, there was also an element to having new. Her house was she was the first owner of the summer house.
Brand new.
There was something about having a new house, new everything. It was a sign of prosperity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, it was, you know, you had a driveway garage for your car and all that kind of stuff. So there are, and bigger, you know, compared to downtown, huge, relatively huge lots. Ours wasn't that big, but it was in comparison to what you have down here.
Well, and considering that you were 8 at the time, it's not that you were 15 or 16, so you were more flexible, I assume. I mean, you left some friends behind, friends that you took a half hour to walk 2 blocks with.
Yeah.
But it's not like you were older, some you them, might have resisted.
Yeah, some of them rejected. Actually moved up north, too.
Yeah.
So eventually, a lot of them were there. There was one that didn't. So I remember with one of my best friends who lived on Markham. But
were there any shuls around here at that time?
There were lots of shuls in the Kensington Market area. The Chmelnicker Society at that time had their own shul, which was at Huron and Dundas. Mm-hmm. So that's where we went.
Yeah.
And it was an Orthodox synagogue, so it had a gallery for the women and stuff.
Right.
So, and then when people started to move, they bought another building at Winona in St. Clair, which is now a Russian Orthodox church, I believe. And after people really started moving up into Bathurst Manor area, they bought a piece of land. They were going to, but I was talking about building a synagogue, but it never occurred. So they never had another congregation. Some of the smaller congregations did do that. So they have small little synagogues up north.
There are lots of them, yeah. Before we move on, I'm wondering if either of you want to talk a little more about the stores, that, like you talked about the fish store that was next to Harbor Bakery, and you talked about all the stores on College. Anything more that you can think about the stores in the neighborhood?
You know, I don't remember them specifically.
Yeah.
You know, I remember the variety store. I remember Becker's and I remember Bakery's, but I don't remember the name.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The one that had the biggest impression, because we didn't go out that often, was the delicatessen, right? So you could buy a hot dog.
And that was Becker's.
Yeah. I think it was on the south side of College, right at Spadina.
But what's also so significant is they knew you. You knew them and they knew you. You knew their names and they knew your names. And they also knew what you wanted.
Yeah,
you know, this kind of haircut or this kind of
boot. Yeah, they knew all the.
Yeah, yeah.
We were all. When it was, kids have a lot of, can do a lot, but we don't let them anymore because we're too scared.
Yeah.
When we moved up north, I registered myself in school. I walked to the school and registered myself. I was 8.
It's so different now. But I agree with you, Barry. I don't think it's any more dangerous. I just think that...
Our perception is
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
So it's... I walk by my old house lots of times. You know, I finish a clinic at the Western and walk home. I walk up Borden. And a few years ago, the door was open and there were contractors working. So I went in and I said, look, I used to live here. You got to let me see it. And... So I did, but you know, my mind had reversed. I had a good picture of it, but I had a mirror image of it somehow in my mind, and which it couldn't be because it had to be the way it is. It was the north half of the semi, but it was very interesting. So it was being, you know, it was just torn up, so you couldn't see very much. But the new owner subsequently had a garage sale. So I went to the garage sale and said, you got to let me take a look at the renovation. She's actually a very famous theater director, Leah Cherniak.
Yeah.
So
she was probably quite delighted, I would think, to let you in.
She wasn't unpleasant. That's
yeah.
She was very nice.
Yeah.
Whether she really wanted it or not, I don't know.
So your mom, I think, used to say that when your dad had the feathers from the chickens, he used to sell them
to Ed Mervish.
To Ed Mervish,
yeah,
his mother.
Yeah.
Who would sew them into pillows.
Pillows for honest heads.
So I just remember that when you talk about stores.
Yeah. It always seemed to be the other major thing was the Bellevue Theater. It's, it, which is a second-run theater just between Spadina and Bathurst, a little bit closer to Spadina on the north side.
No, I think it was on College.
On College. And that was all the kids in the neighborhood went for the double bills on Saturday, which were kids' movies. And it was fabulous. It was 15 cents to get in. And I could get a quarter for my mom. So I got 15. So admission on a box of popcorn. But boy, you got thirsty without a drink because it didn't quite extend to a drink. So you had to run out in between to get a drink from the fountain. But it was great because we could go there every Saturday for a quarter.
With a pile of kids.
With a pile, yeah.
Again, it's the same thing back.
And when I was 10 or 11, I joined the JCC.
And where was it?
It was at Lord Spadina.
Okay, yeah.
And I was part of a group called the Tweeners. That was not the weird, like, preteens, but they called them, that was the Tweener group. And I belonged to the bowling league and the summer camp and then all these activities that you go down on Sundays. So I belonged to the JCC till I was about 13 or 14. And I made friends with kids who still lived in the area. I had a friend who lived at Robert in Sussex. Mm-hmm. And she always, felt funny about still living downtown. And we didn't go to her house a lot. She would come up to mine.
So she was a little embarrassed?
A little bit, because her parents still lived down here. But then within a couple of years, they moved up to Bathurst Manor. And then we got to go to her house more.
So her family had made it by that time.
So, but that was later. So if I was 12, what was that? That was the 60s, the early 60s.
So the JCC was significant for you at that tweener age.
Absolutely. And yeah. My sister, when she got married, her first job was at the JCC. She was head of arts and crafts. So, yes.
And one of the big things is I was walking up to the Santa Claus Parade in November, because that was only a few blocks north.
It's still fun. I once made a brunch. I was living here, and I made a brunch, just invited all kinds of friends. And by the time they got here, I thought they would kill me, because it was the day of the Santa Claus. Who remembers that it's in November? And they had to get across
Bloor. It's Bloor. Very difficult.
It was hell. I'll never do it again.
The key that you have, you assume that you're going to be trapped in your house till 1 p.m. In this
or
area.
Else watching the Santa Claus Parade.
Yeah, or else going.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember it being much colder during the Santa Claus Parade when I was a little boy, though.
You know what? It might have been. Also, when I go to the JCC sometimes at 9 in the morning, the families are already sitting there, and it doesn't start till 12 or 1. So people sit outside for a long time to get the best seats on the curbside.
Yeah.
So you're saying that it was predominantly Jewish. Your family had a business here. Your family lived here. It was predominantly Jewish. But I guess on the street, the language was English.
Yeah.
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 Do you remember other ethnic groups moving?
Sold our house to an Italian family. So there was a lot of Italian people moving in by the time we were leaving. And our house got delayed, so they moved in. So it was two adults and two kids also moving in, so for about 2 or 3 months.
So they didn't force you to leave. You all just stayed there.
No.
Now that's unusual. That wouldn't happen today.
Not anymore.
It's ours.
Yeah.
Find some other place. Yeah.
I'm sure they had my parents and them. They had a financial agreement about it, but it's still everybody was very nice.
Yeah. So you didn't learn any Italian those few weeks?
No. It was a couple months, I think, that was the overlap.
Do you remember much about what kinds of work people were doing, and also whether some of the women were working or many of the women were working?
Very few of the women were working.
Uh-huh.
That was still the era when I was a little boy, until we moved away, the milk and eggs were delivered. Well, not for us, because we got our eggs from my father. But,
right.
But the milkman, and it was still horse-drawn carriage. So we'd go, and they were, the women were there, and all the women knew the mailman because he came by when they were at home, not working. So there were some, like my aunt, my father's brother's wife worked full time, but most did not.
And what was she doing and why was she working? Because she was the exception.
Yeah, well, my uncle had a store in Kensington as well. He had no partner.
Oh, so she was.
And she, if anything, she was a better worker than he was. Yeah. She was incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying the women stayed home. Talk about this horse and buggy. What's that?
That's how they delivered milk. So, you know, he knew what you wanted. And if you wanted something other than your usual, you know, you'd leave a note on the front porch.
Rolled up in a milk bottle.
Yeah.
Because you left the bottles
at the collected. You left the old ones to be collected, and he brought the new ones. And if there was a change in your order, you left a message. You're having guests or something or a party or whatever, you'd leave a message for him. But the horse knew where the next stop was. So he would go and give a couple, go to the next door, leave their thing because he had a thing. And as many as he took, the horse knew to stop where he was going to be finished, because they did it the same way every day, right? Because almost everybody at the time was the same order. So unlike a van, the horse could figure it out. So it's fascinating to watch sometimes when you saw them come. And the other thing I remember is people complaining about the mail delivery, because you had mail delivery twice a day from Monday to Friday, but Saturday was only once. And people thought, you live with mail delivery only once on Saturday.
Bad service.
Yeah, that's what we consider.
Next election will change it.
Yeah. So that nowadays we'd say, not bad.
That's right. It's more than twice what we have now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you touch the horses at all?
No. I don't remember doing it.
Yeah.
We used to go out and watch them. Didn't want to disturb them, I guess, or scared of them. I can't remember. I was little. But it was fascinating to watch them.
And the back lanes, did any of your neighbors have horses in the back lanes?
No horse. No, there was no... horses were not allowed. Mm-hmm. Permanently. This was mode of delivery.
Right,
that's all.
Right, right.
And most of the, you know, the laneways, not everybody had garages in them. So there was really not much there. It was just a way to make a shortcut for us.
Okay, now that we're at the back of the house, I want to talk about the back of the houses. What you had as gardens, whether they were used or front porches, fronts and backs, please talk about that.
We didn't used to play in the backyard, particularly, other than getting it was small, mm-hmm. other than getting, and it had that huge tree in the middle, so you couldn't. Because if you wanted to play games, you could go to the schoolyard. We played on the street.
Yeah.
So it was, but nobody had air conditioning, obviously, in those days. So on hot summer nights, everybody in the whole street was sitting on their front porch. And because the front lawns are so small, you could water the whole front lawn while you're sitting and talking to your neighbors beside you. You didn't even need a sprinkler because they were so small, and you were going to be sitting there for a while because it was too hot to sit inside. So I remember nobody had barbecues or anything like that in the backyard.
So the backyards were a more modern era. It was the front. People congregated in front.
Yeah, that's where everybody sat in the front.
Yeah.
On Borden Street in those days.
Yeah.
And there's on Howland, not too many. Helen and I are the rare ones who still like to sit out, because we're right opposite the park. So you see all the dogs running around, the kids playing. So it's a neat place to sit and watch the world unfold.
I moved down about 25 years ago, and I was living on Robert Street at the time, and a huge amount of sitting out in the front. I loved it. We'd sit out till 11:30, 12:30 in the morning, and just yak, and neighbors would pass by and come. It was just a lovely way, kind of Jane Jacobs sidewalk living.
Yeah, no, and when I was a boy, that's where I was. But I think a lot of that is driven by nobody had a television, because that was a brand new thing, and nobody on Borden Street that I knew of, none of my friends had TVs or anything like that. And I think we got one the year we moved or something. And so there were televisions were not there, and air conditioning was not available. So summer evenings.
But in some way, people talk about the good old days or the bad old days. But that, I think, was good in terms of a feeling of neighborhood and friendliness.
You knew all the kids on the street.
Yeah.
Like nobody, parents organizing a play date would have been a foreign language.
Yeah. That's for our grandchildren. It was predominantly Jewish. As Italian people moved in, did people mix with each other or did that not really happen while you were here?
I don't, for the kids, we had some, the had some friends who were not Jewish, because you went to school with them.
Yeah.
I can't tell. My father would mix with anybody. As long as you could talk politics or something, he was ready. It didn't matter what you were.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how close the communities were, but there was no. There didn't seem to be particular antagonism.
Yeah, I think especially after people have been through what your parents lived through, they want to be with people that they share more with. Anything about traffic? One thing you said was there were very few cars.
Well, there was traffic on the streets.
Yeah.
So that I remember not, you wouldn't, even those days, you would not cross College Street without the light unless you're foolhardy.
Yeah.
So you always went to where the light was. But the side streets, there were no cars around whatsoever, no cars parked. So it was a very different looking streetscape.
Extremely different, yeah.
And Spadina had the angle parking.
Yeah,
and that was until very recently.
Yeah.
But I remember
that was crazy on Spadina.
Being a kid, Spadina was always a crazy street.
Yeah, trying to cross that was
traffic.
That was wild.
People were always double parked, and yeah, always crazy street.
What are some other memories that you might have? Because you weren't living here, but you came down a lot through all those years. Anything else that just kind of comes into your mind?
I don't know. No, I can't pinpoint anything else. Other than shopping, even though we lived at Bathurst and Glen Grove, my mother did her shopping downtown, so in the market, or on Harvard Street. That's why I know Harvard Fish, Harvard Bakery.
And there were a lot of...
It was a dairy as well.
A lot of Jewish people moved up to the suburbs who still didn't trust poultry from the supermarket. So my father did a thriving business. He would, Thursdays, he hired a driver, guy who had his own cab, and he would spend the afternoon delivering chickens on Friday. My father would, to close neighbors of ours, my father would deliver them himself at the end of the day. But, you know, for Shabbos, everybody's going to make a chicken soup or whatever. So they didn't believe that the supermarkets would have good chickens. According to my father, the supermarket got first choice and they had better chickens. But that's a different issue. I don't know which is true.
These are wonderful stories.
One of the interesting things is the person who gave my father his first job here, Irving Ungerman, is now a patient of mine. So it's so nice to be able to help somebody who was the first person to help my father when he came to Canada. Non-relative to help my father. So that feels very, very good.
Well, yeah, you know, I was thinking as you were talking, you know, dealing with the chickens and whatever you had to do, that you went into medicine and you didn't have to go into psychiatry because you were afraid of blood. You're not afraid of bodies and fluids and things like that.
You get used to it, even if you think you're afraid,
you get used to it. Healthcare, what was around here in terms of clinics, doctors?
So when I was little, Fred Weinberg was a pediatrician. He was a very famous, he had a phenomenal collection, later I found out, of antique medical equipment and stuff. And his wife was a famous
Cherry.
Joy Cherry.
Yeah. I used to jog with Freddie.
And very, very nice man. I remember he would do house calls all the time.
Aww.
But when we moved up north, he very rarely did house calls. He moved his office up north as well, where, you know, following the migration of kids up north. But it was a different world. Most of the people then had cars they could drive.
So
he
the home
very,
visits.
He was a very, very nice man. I remember once when my parents took me to see kids, and they wanted to operate and take out my appendix, and he said it isn't, and he was right. So I saved an operation.
And our doctor.
But the home visit is something that happened at that time.
It still does, but to a much lesser extent.
Yeah.
And our doctor was Joe Greenberg, whose office was on Ulster and Bathurst.
I'm trying very hard to interview him. I just spoke to him yesterday, and I'm hoping that I'll interview him on Tuesday. I was at his brother's house yesterday, taking a picture of him, because I interviewed his brother a few months ago. And while I was there, his brother called him and said, I called his brother Muddle. He said, Joe, you have to speak to Eleanor again. So I'm hoping to see him Tuesday. But he was your doctor?
He was my doctor. He was our family's doctor for a number of years. And then I left him when I was about 18.
Now I'm his doctor. But not among others.
Yeah.
Everybody's
doctor. Yeah. They're all left.
But when I was working at the Western with Rosemary Meyer and Erica Lautenschlager, he referred patients to us. And they all loved him. Yeah.
So when my mother died in February, he came. David, his son, brought him to our place for the Shiva. He's a little frail to come by himself now, climbing the stairs. He needs help. But he should write his memoirs. It doesn't have to be a complete memoir, but just stories from each of the decades of his practice and how the population around him changed and stuff. Even from a Jewish perspective, forget about your patients, because he still worries about them, even though he doesn't really practice. I said, write some of this stuff down, because his memory is very good still.
That's why I have to get to interviews.
Yeah. So tell him that you spoke to me and that I still want him to write his memoirs. Doesn't have to be a life history. That's not what I think would be interesting is how he observed the changing of the city through the way his practice changed. I think it would be fascinating.
Well, I'm hoping. Every time I've spoken to him, he's kind of put me off. Soon. But I think I'll phone him tonight, remind him, tell him I'm coming Tuesday. And Tuesday, I think I'm going to call him and be a little bit assertive. Yeah. But he's a lovely man. And of course, the shul that he started, right. He kept it afloat single-handedly.
Yeah.
So it's known as the Shari Tzedek, but also as Joe Greenberg Shul.
Right. Did he start it, or did he rescue it? It was in disrepair and unused, and I think he resurrected it. I think that's the story.
But I know that there was a period that it was really, really declining.
Yeah, and he did everything. Yeah. Like he raised the money. He was a president in perpetuity, it seemed, and did everything for it. I've never been in it.
Well, my middle son had his bar mitzvah at that shul 30 years ago, because Misha's 43. So 30 years ago, we made Misha's bar mitzvah there. Wow. It's a charming, lovely place. It's still very nice. Okay, so we've talked about Kensington Market, how significant it was. I was going to ask about the university, but you would have been too young to. You know, I ask people about the significance of the university in this area.
For me, I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah.
It wasn't important like Eaton's College Street, because if you walked Eaton's College Street, they then had a free shuttle bus that took you down to the main Eaton's at Queen Street. And so then you could explore the Eaton's Annex and stuff like that. I used to love going down there.
Especially Christmas, the beautiful windows.
Yeah, we always used to go down to Simpsons and Eaton's for the Christmas.
The university didn't come into my knowledge until I was about 16 or 17. And then I used to come down and walk through Philosopher's Path and just think how beautiful it was. And, you know, it would be nice to one day go to the university.
But there was a big expansion of the university in the 60s, so it didn't have the same footprint in the 50s when I was living down here. Mm-hmm. So it was a much smaller place.
Well, not the same footprint, and also as a child, your universe was a small one.
Yeah.
And it was Borden and College.
Yeah.
And the marketplace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brunswick, you're already, you know, pushing the limits. You know, we had to go over. I had to go over to Mark, because I had a friend who lived there. But you know, that you didn't go much further. I don't remember playing on Palmerston. You know, it was way too far away. Yeah. Go to Mark.
You didn't go far away, but by the same token, you were much more independent in your little neighborhood.
Yeah, because you had your favorite variety store. You had a couple of bakeries. Your barber. Your favorite restaurant, they were all within a couple hundred meters of each other. So it's like now, density is incredible.
Yeah, and there's a... Now, part of that is changing right now because I have some clubs there.
Okay.
So the after-hour clubs are causing the people on, not Borden so much, it's more Lippincott. It's noisy and there's some damage happening to the property. So that area is changing.
You have sympathy.
We're fighting it.
I don't have as much sympathy for the people who moved into the entertainment district to be close to the action. And when they move there, say, it's noisy here.
Yeah,
right. Duh.
Yeah. This is different, though.
This is very different. It's a quiet residential area, and it changes that way. That's invasive.
Yeah.
Our son lives on Lippincott.
Oh, does he? Near where?
Right across from the from King Edward, from their playground.
So just south of Ulster.
Just between Ulster and College.
Oh, so he's okay. I know. That's where I vote. At the school there. Yeah, it's down near College, very close to College, that the people are suffering. Okay, so I've really covered everything, but I'm wondering...
And just on the other side of Lippincott was Chicago 58 Factory for years, when they made all the salamis and stuff. They moved out of the suburbs 20-odd years ago.
But that was just
a block.
When I was working at the Western, they were there.
Yeah.
When I was working at the Western, they were still there. Yeah. Okay, so when you knew that we were going to have this discussion, was there anything that you thought, this would be an interesting story to tell? Or was there anything that I have not asked about?
I can't think of anything.
Okay. Well, I just want to say thank you. I mean, you both come from very different sources in terms of knowing the neighborhood so many years ago.
She was a Harvard person. I would be far north from
that. That's right.
We lived up north.
But you came back. Here you are.
Yeah.
You're north of Bloor now, but on the same street.
Yeah. Well, the question is, why did people leave? And I think one of the things was, as things changed, people got worried about the schools. And then what happened is that everybody started sending their kids to private schools, so the schools didn't matter anymore. And so people would say, well, where's convenient to live? So I think that's one of the drivers. And now, of course, people realize it's expensive for a private school, and the schools around here have really improved. Again, when I was a kid, they were very good schools, and I think that's... they're becoming really good schools again.
Well, and certainly this population, I mean, the Jewish families were always extremely devoted to excellent education for their children.
I think that what makes a good public school is that the parents demand it around them. And so you put pressure on to perform.
Yeah.
You have any bureaucratic edicts you want from the government, but they're too far away to really influence teachers and principals, but parents can.
And we do. Anyway, I will turn this off. But before I do, I just want to say thank you, Helen, and thank you, Barry, for really a treasure of interesting information and your experiences. So
you're
thank
welcome.
You very much.
You're very welcome.